Welcome to our second meeting of the Healthcare Cost Study Group here at the House. We have members joining us in the room, members joining us on the phone, so welcome to everybody. We are getting a little late start, as usual. We're still working out technology kinks here before session starts. But today's meeting, we are going to focus on care models. Last time we talked to kind of broadly about what our demographics are, and in this meeting we're going to talk about what care models are emerging and existing here in Minnesota. And we're going to switch up the order a little bit, and so I'd invite the Northwest Metro Alliance representatives to come down and join us. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. Yeah. Bundling up and coming outside.
Yeah, boy, this is the last time, though, I think. It's all above zero from
here's
here on
hoping.
Out. That's my plan.
Here's
I'm
hoping.
Dr. Penny Wheeler. I'm the President and Chief Clinical Officer of Allina Health.
And welcome. I'm Brian Rank. I'm Executive Medical Director of Park Nicollet Health Partners Care System.
Great. Thank you. Feel free to proceed.
The Northwest Alliance is a collaboration of two care systems that Penny and I go back a ways in this collaboration of understanding that we were responsible for the care of, together our two care systems were responsible for the health experience and affordability of patients and citizens in the Northwest area of the Twin Cities. And so I'll give you a little bit about background of where we came from, something about improving health, and you can see on the second page our, yes, you may be able to borrow that.
Maybe a little more complicated, just because your presentation is on that.
Okay.
Sorry for the interruption.
No problem.
It would be useful.
Your fingers are probably better than mine.
Probably not, I have huge hands.
Almost there. Try it now.
All right.
There you go. Okay. So the alliance goes back about 8 years, in which we recognize that we were responsible for the health and cost of care together in the Northwest area of the Twin Cities. So we'll go through a little bit about the background of the alliance, improving health in the Northwest Metro area, our triple aim results and destination, and some recommendations to the committee, and then we'll be able to take feedback and questions. And Penny and I are going to trade off. A little bit of background: Health Partners is a not-for-profit, consumer-governed organization. We are integrated care and financing, and so have. You want to come back? Okay.
They're all off now.
Okay. So, hang on. I bet I can do this.
Don't know.
Okay. We got it?
We'll see.
There you go.
It's up.
Ta-da.
Technology. So a little bit about Health Partners, and I'll go to this. Not-for-profit, consumer-governed, and we're an integrated care and financing system. And so we have data from a couple of different ways. We have both claims data to analyze practices, and we have electronic medical record data. We're now 22,000 employees in the organization, and cover 1.4 million people and health and dental members of the of Health Partners. 50 primary care clinics, 55 medical and surgical specialties, multi-payer. We care for over a million patients in our care system today, with about 1,700 physicians and another 600 advanced practice clinicians. We have 7 hospitals in western Wisconsin and in the Twin Cities. And we have 60 dentists in 21 locations in the Twin Cities. Honey?
So Allina Health is also a not-for-profit organization. It differs from Health Partners in that there's no payer integration at all. We're solely a provider organization. So we have 12 hospitals, over 90 clinics, everything from home care to hospice in there, and about 26,000 employees.
So the Northwest Twin Cities metro area is what we call the Northwest Alliance. Our work together is takes into account the both the Health Partners clinics and the Allina medical clinics in that region and Mercy Hospital. And you can see the area on this slide of the of what we consider the Northwest Alliance and working in the place that we work together. Our aims in this, as we came together, were to say, what could we do together to improve health experience and the affordability of healthcare in the Northwest Alliance, recognizing that we could influence a lot of that. And so the triple aim from the IHI white, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement white paper of simultaneously improving the health of the population, improving the experience of the individuals, which includes safe, timely, efficient, effective, and equitable patient care, and then affordability. The background is we care for about 300,000 people together. We have a long-term agreement now that is about 8 years old, I think, to create strategic integration and partnership around the care of those patients. What we originally set out to do was to align and improve clinical strategies so that we wouldn't have to duplicate services and that our primary care and specialty care clinicians could work together for the optimal outcome of that patient. It also has served as a learning lab for us on how do we understand our practice and what drives cost, what drives patient experience, and quality metrics. And we economically integrated about around the outcomes for patients, to optimize the performance and to limit capital-intensive services to what the community needed and not necessarily to in a competing care system. And I think we did have a critical shift at one point in time of how do we move from competition in this area to really focusing on what patients, since we're responsible for that care, to what patients and communities need. The Alliance team is Mercy Hospital, both inpatient and outpatient services, the Allina Health Clinics, Coon Rapids, the Women's Health Center at Coon Rapids, the Champlin, Elk River, and Ramsey Clinics. Health Partners Medical Group has clinics in Coon Rapids, Anoka, and Andover, and Elk River. We have relationships. We have some internal specialty care in both Allina Health System and Health Partners Care System, but there's also a lot of integration with community specialty docs up there, too. We impact the care of probably about 300,000 people between us, and what we've done is then take our economic analysis from the commercial Health Partners patients and use that to understand the economic aspects of our practice better. And I think there's 21,000 people in that we can actually then extrapolate our care to the larger 300,000. Together we care for about 12,000 Medicaid patients as the ACO model pilot attributed to Northwest Alliance and Health Partners Clinics. And Allina has is part of the Pioneer ACO for the Allina clinics in that region also. Just a kind of a governance structure is that we have an oversight council in which our clinic, and we have both the clinical integration committee and a contract and financial oversight committee so that we can actually understand the economics of our care. We have hospital teams, primary and surgical specialty work groups. Mental health has been an important part of our understanding of why costs were driven in the way they were. And then the community health work group about what things we can do upstream to improve the health of children and others in the community. And then as individual topics come up between our clinicians of wanting to, thinking that there are other things that will pop up, we have ad hoc triple aim work groups. Let's see. What drivers of health care costs in general, and even as we understood the particulars of the patient population in this region, it's both healthy behaviors. Smoking is a big driver of healthcare costs, and other unhealthy behaviors, obesity, chronic diseases and an aging population drive costs. Payment systems of understanding costs and whether we value, or whether we pay for volume versus rewarding efficiency and population health. Care integration, episodic care and fragmentation of care delivery. I was telling Penny I was sat with my mother in the emergency room after a fall till 2 a.m. this morning, and I was the transition for her. Quality and evidence-based medicine, we try to understand variation in practices and why that happens and what we can do to support our clinicians and patients toward better care. And then the other things that drive costs are new drugs, technologies, services, and procedures that we want to use in the best evidence way possible. And while we thought we might have a single magic bullet at one time of what we could do to decrease cost in the Northwest Alliance, it turns out that it's a hard slogging work and hundreds of little things. I think Don Berwick once said it's not just one thing, it's everything. And the good news is it's not more than that. And then I'm going to turn it over to Penny.
Just continuing on the theme, it's not just one thing, it's everything. So this is I won't go through these bullet points, but I will chime in to say that what Brian says is absolutely correct, that we learned that it wasn't one big idea, it was several things that we had to do. Another thing was we had to do them together. We would have really had what we call the tragedy of the commons had we all both self-optimized as organizations and not tried to do this collectively together. And when Brian and I get the chance, because of the results you'll see, to speak about this nationally, and people will say, what, you're competitors, right? And we'll say, yeah, but we're collaborators too in terms of decreasing the health burden for our community. And they look at us like we have an arm growing out of our head. And then they say, oh, yeah, that's right, you're from Minnesota. So that's oftentimes the comments we get. But this is several initiatives. Let me just walk you through a couple of examples of this. You know, on the prevention side, we've done flu shot clinics that have extended from, you know, six high schools to homeless shelters. On the community side, we've done 9,000 health risk assessments to determine who really needs care and do that. On the community side, again, we've done, we have an initiative around pediatric obesity and addressing that together in a collective way and a consistent way. We have used our transport system to actually transport people to mental health care visits and opened up access to those who have mental health needs and can't get access after they've been discharged from the hospital. So these are the kinds of things that we have done collectively. Again, not one thing, but many things. It's been across the continuum of services. They haven't just stopped when somebody's been discharged from Mercy Hospital. It's not like somebody's washed their hands. They've been actually picked up and helped supported through their continuum journey. And I think that the big thing and the drum roll sides are just about to come. But, you know, we've made care better and we've made it more affordable. So here's just dozens of ways that care has been made better, and there's measurable improvements in decreasing readmissions for patients, increasing the use of generic drugs, decreasing high-tech imaging, increasing access to mental health services, and the list goes on. But it was these many things that Brian said. And then when we get to the cost side of things, this is the other drum roll side, is that we sat above the market collectively for healthcare costs. We were at 8% when the market was at 5%. And now we've been consistently below the market while care has gotten better. So we really feel that this collaboration has fulfilled the triple aim in big ways, making healthcare better, making our experience better for those we serve, and actually decreasing the cost substantially in doing so. And then we have a unique arrangement with a payer arm of Health Partners that we share in the savings between the organizations. So both organizations share in incentives that reward good work, which is going to be a theme when we talk to you about lessons learned and maybe how you can support this and help. So this is a journey. You know, sometimes we feel like a fish out of water, and today we got our results back for January, and our hospital volumes were way down. And in a way, it's like, well, shoot, because that's still our financial engine in fee-for-service models, right? So I'm thinking and looking at that like, darn, and I'm looking at that for the health burden of the community and saying, well, good. You know, the only problem is with the current incentives, we can't have anything left to reinvest in care. A lot of these initiatives that we've done that have done so much to reduce the cost of care aren't things that are currently reimbursed. So that's a challenge. We think that this is just a starting point. And we're down this, and we think there's a long road ahead in these models where everybody collaborates for the best outcomes for our patients. But at the same time, we think that this is the one place that unites the outcomes for all. It's better, if you look at outcomes per dollar spent, it's better for the patients you're serving, the communities you're serving, it's better for the individual organizations, better for those who pay for care. So we think that that's a uniting principle among all of us and one thing that aligns all interests where the current environment, which is primarily pay for volume, does not. So that's bottom line. I'd say in terms of our recommendations to you, and then we'll take some questions. One is that making sure that we pass legislation that ensures that we can exchange information effectively. We hold the sacred trust that we have a sacred trust with those we serve that their information is kept private. But we've swung, I think, and many would say too far, in that we're making it very, very onerous for organizations to share information about somebody's care without onerous consent forms at multiple points in times and opting in and opting out when it actually fragments their care all the more to not be able to share this information between organizations. The other is one I mentioned, and do you want to make a comment about that too, Brian?
For example, somebody being hospitalized at Mercy Hospital and then coming back to a Health Partners clinic. they have to go to the clinic to sign for the information to come from Mercy Hospital. Makes it much more difficult for the to support safe transitions in care.
Right, right. That's been especially true, too, as we've seen it as the transition for some of our mental health patients and not being able to get their information to the next site of care. Consider restructuring payment incentives, and that's a theme, obviously, so we can afford to build the infrastructure that's necessary in terms of both technology and data and integration and, you know, high-touch capabilities like care coaches and care coordinators that aren't currently reimbursed but are critically important to manage that continuum of care. Demonstration projects are important. This was one that has paid off in a substantial way for its results, but there can be more demonstrations like this that can prove this. And then, you know, the other thing, and I have to give kudos to our partners in Health Partners for this, is using things that have been endorsed as total cost of care measures nationally. And Health Partners went through the National Quality Forum and went through a year of rigorous things. And quite honestly, I'll say, as an organization who's looking at the information of how to manage things, you basically can manage things. You can't tell if you get us that we're 5% above the market. If somebody tells you that, you can't tell what's price and what's your utilization. But the way that some of these consistent measures are done and delivered by Health Partners that has, again, been vetted nationally helps us to be able to manage what we can control, which is the appropriate utilization measures. So let's eliminate all unhelpful variation for those we serve and the patients we serve in the community and look at our utilization for those things that really matter and are of value. And the way that that's calculated by that metric helps us as well. So those are some recommendations from some of our learnings as well. So with that, and Brian, I don't know if you have any other comments, but we'd be happy to take questions.
So probably my only other story would be around the ability to analyze data and know where you're better or worse than others is really important. As we started to do the analytics in the Northwest Alliance, we didn't understand the dearth of outpatient mental health services. And so where patients got their care was in the ED, in the emergency room. And that's not the best experience for patients, and it is very costly. And emergency room physicians are often ready to put somebody in the hospital rather if there's not another resource for their care. And so this is our ability to then partner with each other to create outpatient resources for mental health services has decreased the number of people in the emergency room seeking mental health services.
Okay, well, thank you so much for the thorough presentation. Do members have any questions? What Representative Grenhagen?
Thank you, Tara. On one of the slides it says long-term agreement to enable strategic integration and partnership in the Northwest Metro. Could you put that in English, please? What does that mean? If somebody's an average person was sitting in here, I don't know if you quite know what that meant.
So each one of us at prior to this arrangement had a different strategic direction. We were moving in that Penny would think about the Atlanta Medical Clinics and Mercy Hospital. I would think about both the economic model of how do you run clinics and make them economically work. If we don't think about that as a global whole, we end up both buying MRIs and CT scanners and things like that that drive some of the differences in care systems. And so that economic integration of we committing long-term, the patients in our core clinics there, to this alliance and working with Allina for AAAM outcomes was part of what drove Allina to want to partner with us, to know that we wouldn't be moving patients around trying to find a less expensive form of care because we could find it and we had partners who could create that kind of care with us.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up question then, too. Thanks for that explanation. You know, one of the things I picked up from your presentation is that your reduced cost, when you show that graph about from 8% down to, 1.77 or 0.9, something of that nature, you said you're not reimbursed. Is that from government and private insurance plans or from all plans?
I think what I was referring to, first of all, the it might not have shown because you don't have the color, but the 0.9 is where we got. So we're below market. The market okay. is the one that rides above that above that line. So that might not be clear on your graphs. But what I was referring to is that while we've reduced cost, we've had to invest in services that aren't reimbursed to do so. So to provide extra care coordination, extra access to services, extra things like that, we do get reimbursed, you know, in the model that with a multi-year agreement we have with Health Partners and the 27,000 members they have, we share savings if we reduce their costs. But for many of the things that we put in place to try to help coordinate the care and provide the, you know, intelligence, the data and the infrastructure and review of who we could actually support in the best possible way, those are currently services for which we're not reimbursed in an environment that just rewards us for how many things we do to how many people.
Okay, yeah, just one last question.
So basically, if I'm to understand your response, it sounds like you're putting a lot more money into administration that you're not being reimbursed for versus patient care? Would that be a correct
analogy? No, I think that some of these are direct patient caregivers, like care coordinators that support the care, access to mental health services and things like that that support care as well, direct care.
So both of us want to create, where we've failed often in the past is in transitions of care, hospital to outpatient services, clinic to specialty, and as patients have become more complex and more chronic diseases, the ability to support a team in understanding what's happening in the nursing home, what's happening in the transitional care facility, what's happening in in the clinic, and to coordinate that data for the patient is not administration. It really is support for the care team and the patient together in a really complex world.
Just as an electronic medical record and the integration of those information systems are.
Just one follow-up observation, Madam Chair, is that, you know, I talked to a longtime nurse in my district and several of the doctors and an administrative CEO in the hospital, and, you know, their biggest concern is that we're transferring more and more money into government bureaucracy and healthcare bureaucracy at the local level. And we're not doing, in fact, they're hiring additional people for those areas, but we're not doing anything for the doctor-patient relationship. So we're transferring more and more money into administrative and bureaucracy costs and less for the doctor-patient relationship. And in fact, this head nurse, and she's been a nurse for probably close to 30 years, she's a client of mine, and she just said, it's just ridiculous. The way the money's being migrated into things that don't directly help the doctor-patient relationship.
Yeah,
response to that?
Yeah, sure. I would say that this is the exact.
Can we do a brief response? I'm sorry, and then we have a few more questions.
This is exactly the opposite of that. We actually put the care into the people who knew the care the best, the patients and the providers who provided their care, and actually improved care and reduced costs.
Okay, thank you for that. And we have two more people with questions, Representative Albright and then Representative Huntley. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the doctors, on the slide just above it that we were talking about in terms of the initiatives that you've pushed forward, I looked at this list and I know, and I actually have two questions. The first one is with regard to that you, it would appear that you've advanced the cause for urgent care as opposed to the traditional methodology of making an appointment. And I'm just wondering if you could speak to the point, does that increase, keep the same, or actually decrease the cost of care?
Yes.
Dr. Ink.
I think done right, it finding the right resource for the right patient at the right time, whether it's online care, phone care from a care team, support for that, or urgent care. Emergency rooms are very expensive places to give care, and they're often overwhelmed today. And so we want to make sure that we allow our emergency room doctors and nurses to work to their full potential rather than, and that we get care to patients. So I think that appropriately used, it actually decreases cost. And if you look at the data here, it went from 8% trend to 0.9%. And so I don't think you can do it willy-nilly of just adding it in, but we actually recognize a need for other sources of care in this community rather than only the emergency room.
When we looked at the emergency room care in this Northwest Metro, it was 8% above the metro average, you know, in terms of cost, and we realized that there was a dearth of urgent cares and access for people after hours, so about a third of what was being done wasn't something that actually had to be in an emergency room, and it has been one of the initiatives that have helped us, you know, improve access and reduce costs.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, and looking at that same list, it's I don't know if anyone else is struck by this, but it seems like a good portion of these initiatives are focused on working Minnesotans, whether it be for themselves personally or for their kids. Mm-hmm. But as we face you know, the silver tsunami that's coming ashore with
looks like it landed.
Your time is coming, Bubba. Well, they say there's a compensation for every age. I guess you got to find yours. I'm just wondering what initiatives you're planning for, or what you see on the horizon that is I think, you know, the unmet need in terms of silver care, in terms of how do you deliver meaningful health care to an aging population, whether that be through urgent care, through the traditional appointment desk, through outpatient outreach, whether it be a nursing home or in-home care. And I'm just wondering when that shift occurs, or is it being undertaken right now? And what does that look like to your organization?
I think both of our organizations are involved in Medicare ACO pilots. So as part of the Pioneer ACO, and partly that's what infrastructure we need to create to support patients and families wherever they are. We're trying to compete on innovation between organizations too, and so we call it call, click, or come in. And if we understand the patient well enough and family well enough to what resources are available, like for my mother in the emergency room last night, of what do I need to do to keep her safe? Both of us have geriatric teams in nursing homes that are innovative programs like geriatric fracture programs that happen in the nursing the homes themselves and follow up in the nursing home. We both have teams in assisted living facilities and unique partnerships with either Presbyterian homes or other long-term and assisted living providers. I would also say that electronic medical record is really the complexity of care as people get older and get more complex chronic diseases is supporting the team for what do we need to do in the home or telephonic or even electronically with our patients.
Say the other thing, and in your appendix there's some more details about some of the initiatives, but you know, 28% of our costs are in the last 6 months of life, and so a big initiative too has been advancing palliative care and honoring the choices and wishes, understanding and honoring the choices of wishes of those we serve, and most people don't want to spend some of their last precious days in the hospital, and when we understand their wishes better, they're able to spend more nights at home, and that's been yet another initiative. Primary care access is huge for chronic illness management, too, with the demographic shift occurring and the graying of America.
Representative Huntley.
Just a comment, and it relates to Representative Grunhagen's comments about shifting costs to administration. The best testimony I've heard in my career here was from St. Mary's Duluth Clinic and St. Luke's. And I will say that Park Nicollet down here had an exactly almost identical program to treat people with congestive heart failure. And you've probably all heard me say this, but they reduced the spending on these people by 48%, reduced their admissions to the hospital by 80%+, reduced their emergency room visits by 80%+, and reduced their readmissions to the hospital by 80%+. So these 48% less money on these people greatly improved their health, which means a lot of them went back to work. The trouble is, because of the payment system we had then, they lost $1 million doing that because they couldn't get paid for what they did. And what they did is give these people equipment in their homes so they could get on the scale every morning and have themselves weigh themselves and have that wired into the hospital or the clinic, rather, not the hospital. and then they hired RNs to look at the data every morning that these people were sending in. And if you have congestive heart failure, you gain 3 pounds. It can be a disaster. Or it could be you had too much beer the night before. Nurses, the RNs, would then call these people if something didn't look right and find out what was happening, and if looks like they needed their prescription changed, then the RN would transfer them to a nurse practitioner who would change their prescription as was needed. Well, you can't get paid from the insurance companies for the equipment in the people's homes. You can't get paid for the RN, or you couldn't get paid for the RN, because there was no office visit, mm-hmm. and you couldn't get paid for the nurse practitioner because there was no office visit. And that's what they're trying to do, is change the way we pay for these things so that we pay for the results rather than the services.
Thank you, Representative Huntley. One final quick thing from Representative Zuras, and we're going to need to move on to our next presenters.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, it's an excellent point, Representative Huntley. When I was in my throes of congestive heart failure as a kid, it was generally, you'd have to see a big spike at the congestive heart failure following a big Easter dinner. That big salty ham would do us all in. We'd all be in there together getting our Lasix upped. But a question for the physicians. I see one of the recommendations you're looking at, a legislative change around more easily having medical record information available to help coordinate care. And so I want you to kind of talk about, just in a kind of an average patient, what that can mean from going to a general practitioner to a specialist to then some type of procedure within a hospital, having that medical information, that medical record information, be able to be shared among providers, and how that coordination of care can keep our costs down compared to duplicative testing.
You just made the best case for it. Information is critically important. The number of medications that people are on today, missed medication, a transition of care, missed medication, not understanding what procedure happened yesterday or the day before as they come into another site of care. is critically important to not screwing things up for the patient in their life. And if we want to make the promise to patients that we'll know them and care for them, and then that information of their preferences, values, and unique healthcare needs are critically important wherever they go. And it is the information, whether I'm an oncologist, so when I interact with my primary care colleagues, that the patient knows that we're in sync, and that I know the medications that are on. If I change anything, that they're communicating those changes to the other members of the team. Because people end up in emergency rooms or hospitals or other clinics that don't necessarily, and they don't necessarily remember all their meds.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your presentation on a model that's working. We appreciate it. If we could bring forward North Point Health and Wellness Center next. And we have, if you could just introduce yourselves briefly and then proceed with the presentation. Thank you.
I'm probably going to need some technical assistance here to find my presentation. My name is Stella Whitney West, and I'm the CEO for North Point Health and Wellness Center. And I've, even though he's not on your agenda, I've invited Jonathan Watson.
Good morning, members of committee. My name is Jonathan Watson. I'm with the Association of Community Health Centers. I'm the public policy director there. We represent Stella's organization and 16 other federally qualified health centers throughout the state of Minnesota.
So I wanted to say to the Northwest Metro Alliance, thank you for that great introduction, because a lot of the themes that you heard them talk about, you will also hear in our presentation as well. And I think that as your study group starts hearing over and over again, you'll see a lot of these common themes, and hopefully you'll be able to, with laser precision, identify where the areas are where you can actually make a difference in terms of reducing cost of health care, improving the quality, and also the triple aim, the patient experience as well. So I know that I was given 20 minutes, but I think I can cut that down to 15, maybe 10. So.
And just sorry to interrupt, if you guys could just be certain to speak directly into the mic. We have some folks on the phone that will help them be able to clearly hear you. Thank you.
Okay. So North Point Health and Wellness Center, we are located in North Minneapolis, and we have been around for 46 years. We are a community health center, a federally qualified health center. Our mission is partnering to create a healthier community. And for us, the community that we focus on is North Minneapolis. We believe partnership begins with our patients. It also is a partnership with the community. It is also a partnership with our staff and our providers. In terms of our vision, we believe in a standard of excellence in culturally responsive, integrated primary health social services that both strengthen the community and the people that we serve. We believe, again, in that partnership and a shared vision of a healthy, environmentally safe, economically vibrant, stable, and self-reliant community. So just a little bit about North Minneapolis, and you could tell I didn't put this presentation together because I would not have had all these clicks in there. But according to the 2010 census, our service area is roughly about 58,000 individuals. 82% are from communities of color. We've seen an increase in the Latino population, the Hmong population, and a slight increase in the Somali population as well. Don't have to tell many of you that North Minneapolis is one of the poorest neighborhoods in Minneapolis and in Hennepin County. Average home value in North Minneapolis is $78,000 compared to countywide $244,000. Average income per household a little over 28,000 compared to about 63,000 for Hennepin County. And we have some of the highest rates for health disparities. A lot of that is because of smoking, obesity, nutrition, poor physical activity, mental distress. Hennepin County does a study every 4 years called the SHAPE study. Every time I look at it, North Minneapolis is always has the highest rate. And then there is the unemployment. So our center, as I mentioned, is a federally qualified health center. We are unique, and Jonathan will probably talk a little bit more about some of the other community health centers, and that we have a partnership with Hennepin County. So we are a Hennepin County clinic. We are also a nonprofit. We have a incorporated nonprofit, a 501c3. The one unique thing about community health centers, it is truly a consumer governed organization. We have a requirement that 51% of our board members have to be patients of the clinic. I am a Hennepin County employee, yet I report to that community board. They have the authority to hire the CEO. They have the authority to evaluate me. They also have the authority to dismiss me. So I always look at it from that perspective. If you have all those authorities, that's who I report to. So we have a patient base, about 23,000, with over 86,000 visits annually. We have a $28 million budget, about 350 employees, and it keeps growing between 350 and 400. We are a comprehensive primary care health center. We have medical, we have dental, we have behavioral health. This is all in one location. We have an on-site pharmacy. We are part of the 340B program, so we are able to get discounted pharmaceuticals that we pass on to our patients. We have optometry. We have a chemical dependency program that is a dual diagnosis, Rule 31. So people that have both a diagnosis of mental illness and chemical dependency is who we serve. We offer that through our nonprofit. We also have full lab radiology on site. We also have a food shelf, and we provide health screenings, nutritional services. We also have employment services. So North Point has four primary areas that we are strategically focused on, and we have been doing this for a number of years, but we found that these are the areas that if we focus on, we're going to see better health outcomes and realize our mission. Primary care, community health, health equity, and I must applaud the Minnesota Department of Health for that fabulous report, Advancing Health Equity. I think that they hit the nail on the head, and I hope that you as a study group will be able to look at that and the things that they have brought up and the recommendations we support. And then there's the social determinants of health as well. So in terms of community health centers, we are part of a national, and we are we operate under the federal government, and so we are under the Bureau of Primary Care, and Jonathan, you can always jump in.
Sure.
The Public Health Service Act is the law that authorizes community health centers. We receive an enhanced reimbursement for patients that are on medical assistance, and that reimbursement is based on a per visit, so it's not a fee-for-service model. It is a per visit model. We are mandated to serve in a medically underserved area, so we have defined service area or defined population. Mm-hmm. So we have some of our health centers that serve the migrant population, the homeless population, or public housing population. We also are mandated to serve uninsured. So that's one of the things as a community health center. You cannot turn someone away because of their inability to pay or because of their income. So we provide those services, and we will provide on a sliding fee scale. We're not free. I always tell people, because a lot of times they say, oh, you're the free clinic. No, we are not the free clinic. We are the accessible, affordable clinic, but it's not free. And we also provide a full range of comprehensive services. So the types of services that I talked about that North Point provides, it's typical for community health centers.
Jonathan? And let me just chime in on two things here real quick on this slide. We receive a grant from the federal government. That's our relationship with the federal government. The employees of a community health center are not employees of the federal government. Collectively, we receive about $17 million to care for the uninsured from the federal government. And that only covers roughly half of the costs. We provided $40 million of care to uninsured patients last year. And we do, as Stella did say, we do charge the patients, and that contributed about $7 million to offset the cost of that care. We rely on state government grants, local government grants, and private fundraising as well to make up that difference to care for that 70,000 uninsured individuals. So just wanted to clarify those two points.
Thanks, John. Yep. So the community health center model, what are some of the keys to that, and what has actually been proven by different studies? And again, we've been in this business for over 46 years now, so as a national model. So studies have shown that we actually improve access to primary and preventive care, that we provide cost-effective care, that we provide high-quality care, we reduce health disparities, and also we create jobs and stimulate economic growth. So this is a value proposition. So with the value of community health centers, first of all, nationally, we are the largest primary care association in the country. Every time I hear that statistic, I want to jump up and shout. So again, we are the largest primary care association in the country. We save on a national level about $1,200 per patient per year. It was close to about $6 billion, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And we have found that patients that are patients of primary care community health centers are 19% less likely to use the emergency department. They're 11% less likely to be hospitalized, particularly for control of chronic disease that could be controlled in a clinic. And between, it's estimated between 2010 and 2015 that we will save about $23 billion to the states via the Medicaid. And Jonathan knows more about the Medicaid and the reimbursement.
And just relative to the Medicaid program, just looking, honing in on some Minnesota specific data, community health centers serve about 9% of the non-elderly Medicaid patients here in the state of Minnesota, and we do that with about 1.6% of that budget. So it's a good return on your investment looking at it from an investment in the community health centers.
And then also, in terms of quality of care, community health centers nationally meet or exceed those national standards of chronic disease treatment and management. So Minnesota's community health centers, there are 17 centers across the state, both in urban communities and in rural communities as well. We serve a total of 183 patients across the state, over 680,000 visits. The majority of our patients, 42%, are on medical assistance or Minnesota care, 37% uninsured. We do expect that to decrease with the full implementation of the Affordable Care Act. However, the reality is there is still going to be a percentage of uninsured that are going to be receiving services through community health centers. Collectively, 1,300 FTE in staffing. And National Health Service Corps is one of the things that I like to talk about, because this is the value that community health centers bring to the healthcare industry, and that through our affiliation with the federal government, providers that come and work for community health centers as a part of the National Health Service Corps are able to participate in a loan forgiveness. And so that allows us to, again, become a recruitment tool for primary care providers, providers that really want to work in rural communities or medically underserved communities. So it is a real value that we bring for that. I believe the National Health Service Corps just recently increased that, and that provider, if they sign up for a two-year, can receive up to $60,000 loan forgiveness. And so many of our providers come to us under the National Health Service Corps, and even when they're done paying off their loans, they stay. So. And we're an economic engine, 140 million economic activity collectively. I'll go through these pretty quickly. Our integrated model that we have at North Point, we know that integrated care produces the best health outcomes. Being able to provide, and I heard at the previous speaker talk about that, that connection with mental health and primary care. We have mental health providers that are embedded in our primary care, in our medical clinic. That makes a big difference. Using multidisciplinary teams, we use community health workers, care coordination, you heard that a lot, being able to have people that can help navigate through the healthcare system and also through the social service system, particularly important for our population. Having that common electronic health record, we are on the Epic system. That allows us to connect with the hospital, and so that our patients, that when they do become hospitalized, our providers then can get that information, and vice versa. The hospital physician can get information regarding what type of care or type of tests that they have had at our clinic. We are a certified healthcare home. Many of the community health centers are healthcare home certified as well. And we are part of the Hennepin Health Demonstration Model. And I'm going to talk about that because it is a model that if we talk about where there are opportunities for cost savings, this is one that we've been involved in now for 2 years, and we're just now starting on our third year. So it is a ACO demonstration model, Medicaid model, a defined population. So we're working with adults that are on medical assistance between the ages of 21 and 64 in Hennepin County. The partners are all part of the county. So our partner, hospital partner, is Hennepin County Medical Center, HCMC, North Point, and then the Human Services and Public Health Department. And then Hennepin County has a health plan, Metropolitan Health Plan, which actually is the allows us to look at the claim data and being able to manage those patients. We are serving approximately 6,400 complex residents, and this is a full risk, total cost of care basis. And we have seen some really good results. So the premise of Hennepin Health is that you need to meet individuals' basic needs before you can meaningfully impact their health, particularly for populations that are on medical assistance, vulnerable populations. Those social challenges often result in poor health management. There's this revolving door. We do focus a lot on what we call the frequent flyers, or identifying those high utilizers of emergency room, high costs, and drill down to figure out why they are using the emergency room as their primary care. And oftentimes you find it's because there are social needs that are basic needs that are not being met. And so it's cheaper to meet those needs and keeping them out of the emergency room. We definitely know that coordinating the systems improves health outcomes and reduce costs, much like you heard from the Northwest Metro Alliance. The Hennepin Health Care Model is a primary care medical home model, strong community health worker role. We've learned that there are some evolving roles and functions, so having social service navigators, housing is extremely important for this population. It's real difficult to expect that someone who is a diabetic and that is homeless is going to be able to manage that chronic disease. So making sure that they can have adequate housing. Population health management capacity is extremely important. And then outreach to make sure that the members stay eligible. That's always a problem that, again, managing the complexity of the paperwork. And so if we can help with that and keep them on their insurance, makes a big difference. The finance model for Hennepin Health, replacing those volume incentives. So again, that taking away the fee for service and looking at the value incentives, avoiding hospitalizations. And so HCMC is a safety net hospital, much like you heard from the previous speakers, reducing hospital beds and hospitalizations was a chore for them, but when we all got together and we're rowing in the same direction, makes a big difference when you have these incentives to share savings and reinvest in systems improvement. So these are some of the results that we've seen with Hennepin Health comparing 2012 to 2013. So we've seen in our population an increase in primary care utilization, which is what we wanted, and a decrease in the emergency department visits and a decrease in inpatient admissions. In terms of improved quality of care, we've seen, and this is data that we've submitted to the Minnesota Community Measurement, that our population, we saw that there was an increase in the optimal diabetes care, increase in optimal vascular care, and optimal asthma care. So everything is going in the right direction. So I wanted to show you this to say that in terms of looking at what is key to this value proposition in health, this diagram comes from the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute, and most healthcare providers and researchers know this now, that if you look at the fact that healthcare, access to care, quality of care is about 20% in terms of the determining someone's health outcomes. Physical environment, 10%. But you look at the socioeconomic factors, education, employment, income, community safety, 40%. Health behaviors, 30%. So if you add the socioeconomic factors with the health behavior, you're looking at 70%. And so we have taken that message, and we know that the biggest impact that we can have is outside of the walls of our clinic. And so our partnership with the community, making sure that we are truly getting the messages out there, is what we know is going to have the greatest impact, not what happens in that 15, 20-minute visit in the doctor's office, but what happens when they leave. So future of healthcare, certainly focusing on health and wellness, not just managing sickness and illness, prevention and disease management, the integrated health care, community-based health care, population health management, and payment reform, some of the same themes that you also heard from the previous speaker. I, as a baby boomer who has a 85-year-old mother with Alzheimer's, who previously was in an assisted living facility and immediately started declining. And we had her assessed, and she was put into hospice, found that as soon as we were able to put her into a community-based group home care, she started thriving. And so I am definitely convinced that as we started, I heard one of the legislators talk about the gray tsunami, that the more and the closer we can get to community-based care, the better results and outcomes that we're going to see. So, thank you. So we're available for questions.
Thank you so much for the presentation. And members, just due to the time, if there's a real pressing question, we can take that briefly. Otherwise, if we could connect offline connect offline just so we get everybody in who's been here. We're running tight on time. Thank you so much for the presentation and the work you do. Appreciate it. And so up next is the Minnesota Medical Association. And we have Janet Silversmith. You just want to briefly introduce yourself and proceed with your presentation.
Yes, great. Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Janet Silversmith, and I'm the Director of Health Policy for the Minnesota Medical Association. I appreciate the chance to be here today, and I think it actually turned out really well, the order of your agenda. I think the two previous presentations did a great job of providing specific examples of some practical models and demonstrations that are currently in place. I'm going to move you up a few thousand feet and try to provide a little bit broader perspective. And in particular, I want to give a just share with you a quick snapshot of Minnesota physicians, talk a little bit about spending for physician services, and then talk about both past and current efforts. And I think it's on here, so maybe I'll take a quick peek. There we go. So the MMA, briefly, is a professional association of physicians and physicians in training. We actually have a very long history in the state of working to improve the health of Minnesotans and the practice of medicine. And in fact, MMA actually preceded Minnesota statehood by 5 years. We actually share the concerns that this work group has about the sustainability of healthcare spending and look forward to working with you to figure out some solutions. In terms of a quick snapshot of Minnesota physicians, the Minnesota Board of Medical Practices licensed physicians in the state, and there are approximately 21,000 licensed physicians. About 14,000 or so of those are actively practicing medicine in the state of Minnesota. And if you look at the distribution of those physicians by the size of their medical group, you will notice that about two-thirds of actively practicing Minnesota physicians work in medical groups of 100 or more physicians. Whenever we have conversations with anyone in another state, this is a unique aspect of Minnesota medical practice. Most communities and states across the country, physicians practice in much smaller practices and different than the large integrated systems found in Minnesota. I think you saw some of this data last week from the Minnesota Department of Health, but I just wanted to take a minute to, again, highlight the portion of total Minnesota health spending for physician services, which is 19%, or that green slice that is pulled out. Physicians, of course, do have a strong influence on other areas of healthcare spending in terms of the services that they order or the treatments or services that they may refer patients to. If you take a broad picture and look at healthcare spending from 1960 to 2007, the real per capita health spending during that time increased by a factor of 9, or an annual growth rate of 4.8%. The underlying cause of that spending growth during this period, however, is important to understand. Spending on new medical technologies accounted for between 27 and 48% of this total growth. Income accounted for another 29 to 43% of that total spending. And income growth pans out across other countries as well. As a nation's wealth increases, so do does its healthcare spending. You'll notice that demographics play a relatively small portion in total health care spending growth during this period. It's likely that this will shift after 2007 as the baby boom generation continues to age and hits retirement. I also wanted to take just a minute to talk about terminology, not only because it's particularly confusing, but it's also easy for all of us to interchange all the various terms about costs and prices and spending. And costs really can vary depending on where you sit. So if you're a patient, you are particularly interested in what your out-of-pocket costs are or what your co-payments for services may be. If you're an insurer or a health plan, you may be most interested in the costs that you as an insurer face for the specific benefits that you have sold through an insurance product. Those who provide care, physicians and other providers, see cost as the sum total of the labor, facility, equipment, and supplies that they need to purchase in order to deliver a service or a procedure to a patient. For physicians, a lot of factors influence their cost structure. They face labor costs in the personnel that they hire. They face prices in purchasing supplies and equipment. They have they face costs in acquiring malpractice insurance, obtaining supplies, vaccines, other drugs, and devices. Physicians also face costs exerted by external forces. They have overhead costs associated with filing claims with insurers. There are costs for collecting and reporting data for quality measurement. There are costs associated with prior authorizing services with insurers, and there are costs associated with adopting electronic health records, for example. Physicians' production costs are ultimately translated into a service price, which, for a variety of reasons, as you know, is rarely the actual cost incurred by either the patient or insurer. Healthcare spending, on the other hand, reflects actual transfers of money and is the product of the price and quantity for the number of services used across all healthcare services and sectors. A lot of attention by payers, both public and private, has focused on controlling healthcare spending. A lot of effort focused on how to modify either the price of care or the utilization of care. For example, Medicare and Medicaid control prices through set fee schedules for particular services, and insurers similarly work to negotiate discounted rates for the services that they purchase. Utilization control is also very common and was the primary tool used by the managed care industry in the early 90s and throughout the 90s, actually. Utilization control can take a variety of mechanisms. For example, there's the extreme of excluding a service or treatment from coverage. You may limit the number of services that may be paid for through insurance. You may require advance approval of medication or surgery, or you may limit the size and type of the network of providers for whom patients have access. Many of these efforts, however, often have the same effect as squeezing a balloon. An insurer's effort to reduce utilization, for example, by requiring advance review of a procedure, may push those costs onto physicians who simply need to hire staff to process the various approval submissions. Historically, there's been far less attention given to the actual cost of care, the underlying cost structure of the healthcare services, and how to generate more efficient delivery of care. Of course, how care is paid for matters. You heard a lot about that this morning and some of the incentives associated. And all of the stakeholders in healthcare engage in behaviors associated with the economic forces. For physicians, the dominance of third-party payment for services is the fuel that runs the engine of healthcare. There's a health economist at the University of California, Berkeley, who once said that there are a lot of different ways to pay physicians. Some are good and some are bad. The three worst are fee-for-service, capitation, and salary. The point of that quote is actually that there's no such thing as a perfect model. It's really about finding the best combination of those models to achieve the goals that you're really trying to accomplish. But fee-for-service is what we are all living with. It's very dominant. It's really everywhere. And so it's the focus of a lot of debate today as we try to reform the system. And there are certainly limitations associated with fee-for-service that, again, you heard a lot about this morning. Generally, the payment rules require you to see a patient face-to-face. Generally, those face-to-face services have to be done by a physician for a patient. Generally, the payment rules are focused on acute illnesses, so there's less of a incentive to support preventive care and complex chronic diseases. So given the limitations of fee-for-service, a variety of new models are being pursued that would address the deficiencies in fee-for-service, and again, you've heard those this morning. Several of these models assume a shift from managing the health of individuals and taking on the both health and cost management for a population of patients. And I don't want to underestimate that this is a big deal. It's a big deal for physicians because it's a really significant new orientation for them. A survey that was actually led by physicians at the Mayo Clinic and published last summer in the Journal of the American Medical Association surveyed physicians on their attitudes about their responsibility for controlling costs. And in that survey, 36% of physicians reported that they have a major responsibility for reducing costs. That 36% was far lower than many other stakeholders in the healthcare business who they believed had a larger responsibility for managing costs. but nearly 80% of physicians responding agreed that they should be solely devoted to individual patients' best interests, even in the face of expensive care for those patients. I think it's fair to say that when any of us think of either ourselves or our family members as patients, that's the attitude and experience that we hope we experience with our individual physicians. Yet there is, at the same time, a professional responsibility for physicians to be good stewards of financial and scarce resources. And the MMA is committed to helping physicians navigate to that new and expanded role. My point simply is that the changes the system is expecting of physicians are not without tension in the face of the realities of physician training, ethics, and a lot of organizational cultures. The same survey, however, did find that physicians do support a lot of strategies to address costs, despite a general discomfort for quantifying that level of responsibility. Physicians are very clearly supportive of their role in reducing costs if it's phrased in the terms of improving the quality of care for patients. Some of the examples of those, which is a little hard to read, include ensuring that physicians do not provide unnecessary care, that they use clinical guidelines, that they work to ensure continuity of care for their patients, coordination of care for their patients, and that physicians have access to quality and safety data to help them improve the care they deliver. So a couple examples of how physicians in the medical community are working to reduce the cost side of the equation include the administrative processes associated with delivering care, as well as the care delivery processes. From the administrative side, many physician clinics are engaged in collaborations. They may not be formal integrations, but there are partnerships in which clinics are sharing administrative services such as purchasing, data collection, human resources. Credentialing is a significant burden to the system, and the Minnesota Medical Association, along with the Hospital Association and the Council of Health Plans, have been working to try to reduce the costs and simplify and streamline the credentialing process associated with approving physicians for participation in health plan networks and the process for granting privileges to physicians at hospitals. Minnesota is ahead of many other states in its standards for electronic billing and payment and administrative processes, but as other commenters have noted, we certainly have room for improvement in terms of easing the exchange of clinical data to avoid the duplication of care and to better coordinate care across settings. Care delivery changes are occurring as well. Many practices are engaging non-physician providers in record numbers, whether they be medical assistants, nurses, PAs, nurse practitioners, and others, in order to free physicians up to care for more complex patients. Delivery structures are also changing. Part of Minnesota's 2008 Healthcare Reform Act authorized healthcare homes. I like to think of healthcare homes as for the Cheers of healthcare, which probably is a bad bar metaphor, but it also ages me a little bit. But really, healthcare homes are a place where everybody knows your name. If you're a patient, the staff knows you. You are supported and you are cared for, and they are the point of reference for you to navigate the system. There are about 322 certified healthcare homes in Minnesota, and the foundational work that healthcare homes have to do in terms of creating the infrastructure and the capacity to coordinate care and share data is a necessary first step to more complex delivery and payment models. There continues to be experimentation of other payment models as well. Pay-for-performance, which used to be the term of the week several years ago, it's actually still around, though not quite as popular. It is being used by a variety of employers, including a lot of the large self-insured employers in Minnesota, as well as the state of Minnesota. The evidence of pay-for-performance is a little bit mixed. There is some evidence that it will work, but designing effective pay-for-performance programs can be very tricky. We've heard about ACOs this morning. There's certainly a lot of interest, with Medicare really leading the way in formal structures. Minnesota has 7 different models of ACOs in Medicare, and as one example this morning, Medicaid is also in the business of looking at ACOs. At your last meeting, one other point I wanted to make is you heard some data from the Minnesota Department of Health about wasteful spending as a potential source of healthcare costs and unnecessary care delivery. There is a project going on by the American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation that's working with national medical specialty societies to identify their top five lists, to identify those five things that are really unnecessary and that patients and physicians should routinely question as to whether they're appropriate for their patients. And the goal of this Choosing Wisely project is to create conversations between physicians and patients so that there creates a culture of consistently communicating better about the appropriateness of care for patients over time. The MMA has a grant to support this project, particularly in Minnesota, and we're particularly excited about a partnership that we have with the Guthrie Theater to help train physicians in improved communications using improv and other acting techniques so that physicians who may not get more minutes available in their time with the patients, but hopefully they can maximize that time to the greatest extent possible. So we're looking forward to that as a way to build on shared decision-making and other activities to improve communication and reduce unnecessary care. So quickly, in a light of a lot of activity that's occurring in terms of trying to address cost, there are, of course, questions and challenges that remain. It is important to remember that the evidence of a lot of these new payment models is still very limited, and the MMA believes that we're still very much in a testing and experimentation phase. It's really too early to say that they are the answer or that any one particular model is the answer. The implications of some of these models on rural communities, on underserved communities, is also worth paying attention to. And trying to understand what it is we want in terms of our delivery system, in terms of the diversity of size and type of practice. There has been consolidation, which in some ways has been good, but there's a lot of implications of that for some specific communities. So we would urge attention to that as well. So with that, we look forward to working with the legislature to continue to improve the affordability of care, and I'm happy to take any questions if you have any. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Ms. Silversmith, and thank you for giving me a fun fact of the day, the partnership with the Guthrie and physicians. That's a very unexpected twist. So look forward to hearing more about that. Members, I'll kind of stick with the same premise. If there's any burning questions, happy to take those. Representative Grunhagen, if it could be really quick.
One burning one.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
ma'am.
You know, just in, I've been associated with the health insurance and healthcare industry for about 35 years. And, you know, one of the things that drives up cost, according to what I've read, is medical malpractice. You know, you have a doctor right now under fee for service. He has a patient with this condition. He looks at all the services he can order. Well, there's an incentive to order services, generate additional income for yourself. I understand that. But yet, you know, some of the retired doctors I've talked to say, well, one of the reasons we order all these services is because of the threat of lawsuits, okay, for medical malpractice. And yet in Minshew and Obamacare, there's no provision for addressing the abuse of medical malpractice. The Pacific Research Institute did a study a couple years ago showed that 30% of your healthcare costs could be reduced if we reformed our medical malpractice industry. Do you believe that that would be helpful in giving the doctors a better condition or atmosphere where they could actually practice medicine rather than do defensive medicine to protect themselves?
Madam Chair and Representative, the issue of malpractice costs, it's a real issue, as well as defensive medicine and the associated costs that defensive medicine may be adding to the system. Minnesota has historically been very fortunate with the malpractice climate that we have. That being said, there are physicians in particular specialties who do struggle to obtain malpractice insurance, and some pay extremely high premiums for that. So it is something that the MMA is particularly concerned about. I think that from a quantification of the effect of defensive medicine on the cost of healthcare, I'm not familiar with that particular study. The previous studies I have seen show that the cost of defensive medicine in the aggregate when looking at all spending is a smaller percentage than what you had heard. That being said, whether it's reform in that area is necessary to reduce costs, it's definitely something that would improve physician satisfaction with the practice of medicine.
Thank you for that. Really appreciate it. And if we could move on to our next presenter, we've got the Minnesota Hospital Association and Mary Krinke coming forward to present that.
Thank you, Madam Chairs, for this opportunity today. Much of my slides and presentation, I think Janet Silversmith from the MMA has covered a lot of them, but they're slightly different with a slightly different perspective. But thank you. Great. Thank you very much. My first slide today is going to be a little provocative and might cause a few eyebrows to rise, but I think sometimes it's good to put things in perspective. One of the things I wanted to share with you all today is that here in the United States, we've heard so much about how much money we spend on healthcare. It is about 17.8% of our gross domestic product. We spend more than any other country in the world on healthcare. And yes, there is some overutilization, and yes, there are services that are ordered that may not be needed. But I want to just put it in perspective to say that the United States also spends the least amount of our gross domestic product on food. We are blessed here in the United States to have abundance of land, good soil, decent weather most of the year except for around Minnesota. And if you look at that, it kind of puts things in perspective a little bit that we spend 6% of our gross domestic product on food. And the wealthier you are as a nation, you will spend more on health care. And I just want to say that that's not necessarily a bad thing. Quite frankly, spending money on health care has added vitality, length of life expectancy, and it has added to the quality of life for so many Americans. So I just think we need to put that in perspective that we in the United States spend more on health care services, quite frankly, because we can. I know you all have seen these before, but I think it is good to always remind people where we start from here in Minnesota. Just a few weeks ago, the Agency for Healthcare Quality and Research once again came out and said that Minnesota was number one in the nation for healthcare delivery. This was a magazine cover for Modern Healthcare last year that said, Minnesota, where you want to get sick. The map here shows it's from the Commonwealth Fund, and you can see the high-quality, low-cost states are there in the white, and obviously the upper Midwest is doing very well. But I do think that is important in our discussions as well to look at where we are starting from. This is one of my favorite charts, and I know Representative Huntley has seen this one many times. We have just updated it in December. This is known as the Dartmouth Atlas, in which cost is along the vertical axis and quality is along the horizontal axis. And you can see there are a few states that are similar to Minnesota on price. You can see Hawaii and Vermont and Oregon. There's some states that are similar to us in price. And you can see there are some states that are similar to us in quality. New Hampshire, Maine, Wisconsin, and Massachusetts. But when you put them together and you look at where Minnesota is, we are sitting very, very well with being a low-cost, high-quality state. This next chart, I think Mr. Gildemeister and some others have shown this one before as well. This one is a look at our last decade of healthcare spending compared to the inflation rate. And you can see 10 years ago, the healthcare inflation rate was at about 10%, and the overall inflation rate was at about 2.5%. Now you look at the past 10 years and the red line on the top and the blue line on the bottom, and for the first time in over a decade, healthcare spending is actually has a smaller percentage of increase than the overall inflation rate. And I think that that is really pretty incredible, and we need to step back and think about that and really the good work that we have done. This is the entire healthcare community here in Minnesota. Healthcare spending rose just 2% from 2010, marking the second lowest increase in growth in Minnesota since the Department of Health first began looking at this in the mid-1990s. Private spending actually declined a little bit, 0.3%. Overall, public spending did go up by about 4.7%, and we're going to talk about that one in just a minute. Per capita spending in Minnesota averages about $7,145. It's about $1,000 less than the national average. If you excluded Medicare as well as long-term care, we'd be actually spending about $1.9 billion below expectations and projections. The rate of growth in public spending remained virtually unchanged since 2010. Spending did go up in our public programs by about 4.7%. This is from the Department of Health's report, but I do think it is worth repeating here. Public spending grew largely as a result of expanded enrollment rather than increased per enrollee costs. Per enrollee costs actually fell for Minnesota's public programs in 2011. So I know Ms. Silversmith just talked about what costs mean and what prices mean to different people, but we like to think of costs in terms of what the state has paid for. So costs are what the state is paying for. Price is what they pay the providers. Volume is the number of people enrolled in our programs, and services is what services they need. So what this is saying is that the price that they've paid the providers has remained flat or has fallen, and the services were maintaining people who are actually sicker, and the volume has gone up. So where the growth in our state spending is coming from is not what you're paying the providers. It's coming from people being either sicker or the volume going up. It's not what you're paying the providers. Just a couple quick slides, and you all have seen these before as well. This is on the hospital cost structure. You can see that hospitals spend, obviously, a lot of money on our employees. About 51% of our expenses are on salaries. We employ about 113,000 people. Wages are about $6.8 billion. A couple years ago, Deeb did a study on the multiplier effect here in Minnesota, and we have an economic outcome of about $27 billion. We buy a lot of supplies, linens, food, equipment. So the multiplier effect for hospitals is very strong. Charges. I just wanted to show this slide to show where hospital patients come from. If you look at the pie chart here, you can see Medicare fee-for-service and Medicare Advantage is about 38% of our charges, and Medicaid fee-for-service and Medicaid PMAP is another 15%. So for most hospitals, government payers are well over 50% of our hospital patients and our charges. That makes us slightly different than a lot of the other healthcare providers. We do care for a lot of folks on government programs, particularly the Medicare population. I don't want to spend a lot of time complaining about Medicaid rates because I know that's not what your thrust of the meeting here is today. But I do think it is important to point out, because it is driving change. There's a saying that necessity is the mother of invention. And a lot of what the hospitals are doing right now with payment reform has come from our low Medicaid rates. We are currently being paid at 2002 costs minus 26%. So when hospitals care for someone in the Medicaid program, we are at 2002 costs minus 26%. Also, in 2011, they passed budget neutral rebasing. That has yet to happen, but we believe it should be coming this year. I just want to spend the next couple minutes talking about ACOs and some of the other information on payment model reform that I think you were most interested in. Right now in Minnesota, we have six of our members who have signed up to do healthcare delivery system demonstration projects with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Alina, Children's, the Federally Qualified Health Centers, CentraCare, Essentia, and North Memorial. They all have contract agreements with the Department of Human Services. It's like a Medicaid ACO. It's a shared savings contract. And they just started about a year ago, so as Ms. Silversmith mentioned, the outcomes are yet really to be known. We believe they are both going to save money and help coordinate care better for those patients. Hennepin County has a similar project as well. The healthcare homes, the numbers have actually gone up a little bit since Ms. Silversmith's slide. We now have over 250 clinics that are now certified in the healthcare home. I wish Mr. Tom Huntley had been here to see this, because this is part of the 2008 healthcare reform that he brought about. This is the start of starting to pay for services a little differently. It's not a lot, but it is a start. You can see they're starting to pay for two conditions of care, as well as complex conditions. We're starting to pay for services different than under just the old fee-for-service model. I'm trying to get through this quickly here. We have seven hospitals participating in the federal accountable care organizations. These are with Medicare, looking at paying for services differently. They're going to have, you have to have 5,000 beneficiaries to be able to do it. That's why some of our smaller hospitals have not participated yet. You have to have an enrollment of 5,000 Medicare beneficiaries. They're doing 33 different quality measures. They will have both projected cost savings, shared savings, as well as new quality standards. I think getting Medicare to start paying for services differently will be the fuel that changes how we start paying for services. Medicare is such a big purchaser of healthcare services. When they start to make the change, it will quickly take place. I just want to highlight a couple of the recent achievements of the Minnesota Hospital Association. And really, in the 11 years that I've been at the Hospital Association, we really have changed our focus in the last couple years. Everything now is trying to move for more safety, more quality. We have a campaign at the association called RARE, reducing avoidable readmissions effectively. And we have reduced hospital readmissions by over 6,211 readmissions since 2009. And this is a major focus of our members, is to work on reducing readmissions. Also, pressure ulcers and elective deliveries prior to 39 weeks. I found this one really interesting, in that we had asked our members how many of them were doing elective deliveries prior to 39 weeks, and they said, oh, we don't do that. And then when we actually got the numbers on how many of them were doing it, we found out that many were. And so we have now adopted policies in all the hospitals that we are not going to do elective just deliveries prior to 39 weeks. And we've really seen a dramatic change. So you can see the work that we've done in the last couple years is estimated to save the healthcare system over $58 million. The last slide, and I think that this kind of captures what the other speakers said, and that is that this transition to paying for different models catches providers right in the middle of this tightrope. If you bill for fee for service, you're getting paid and you know how to get your pay, and that's the old model of care. And now with the new model of care, total cost of care contracts, value-based purchasing, the new focus is trying to keep people healthy, but the payment model is not totally aligned with where we're heading. And so providers sometimes find themselves caught in the middle. And that was exactly the model, the example that Representative Huntley used with the heart condition cases up in Duluth. So, but that's what we're striving for, and I think our members are stepping up to the plate. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Very impressive. A lot of information, and you did it very quickly. But it's good information. Appreciate it, members. Any pressing questions? Okay, we can move on.
Thank you. Trying to get you out of here by 12:15.
Yeah, appreciate that. Last presenters, we have the long-term care imperative. Do you guys want to briefly introduce yourself? And members have the presentation in front of them in slides.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson. I'm with Care Providers Minnesota.
And I'm Jeff Bostick with Aging Services in Minnesota.
Together we're here to present kind of the older adult services perspective on things. We're asked to give a brief background and then move more into what are we doing now. I don't know if you have a copy of ours or not.
It's not on.
Might not be on there. So you might just have to go old school and do the paper. So some of the key trends in long-term care that are influencing costs and state spending, some of these you heard about the other day when we had the demographer in here. One, there are increased number of people being served across the spectrum. Two, there's continued reliance on informal caregiving. but there is a decline in availability of those caregivers. We'll get to that on one of our slides as well. There's a lack of personal savings to pay for their long-term care needs, and there are an increasing variety of lower-cost services across the spectrum of care, which is trying to respond to those pressures of finances. We are repositioning the use of nursing homes and care centers to try to address some of these things, as well as there's an effort to kind of what we would call flip the entitlement towards housing and community-based services away from kind of the traditional nursing home. So on the next page, you have the demographic imperative, and this is one of the things that the demographer said. Basically, as the baby boomers get older, there's going to be a lot more people with gray hair around that are going to start needing services. It's unfortunate that the representative, but Representative Zerwas, you're around. We will all get gray eventually, so... I didn't think it would happen to me until later on, but, you know, I had two daughters, so they're causing me to get gray even faster. The important thing here on the next slide is the solo economy in healthcare, and this is especially important in long-term care as we have a lot of reliance upon family members as caregivers. And as we have an increasing percentage in Minneapolis, you see we're at about 43%. Of people who are single, so they're living alone now, so they don't have a spouse, may not have significant others, may not have children even to help take care of them. That's going to show up in a lot of different ways that we're trying to anticipate, but that will cause increased costs as we move forward. Another cost driver that we're seeing as we continue to age are the prevalence of Alzheimer's. As we have more older adults that are getting diagnosed with Alzheimer's, this becomes harder and harder for individuals to help them out and care for them at home. They need more services, higher acuity, causes a lot more stress, and it's driving more folks into more of an assisted living or home care type of scenario. As you see down below, the Alzheimer's disease imposes significant costs. A significant number is paid for by Medicare, a lesser number by Medicaid, and then there's some private pay and other sources. Typically, other sources are seen as commercial insurance, long-term care insurance, or other contracted services. On the next slide, you see that Americans needing aging services is projected to increase. There's no surprise there. As we continue to get older, as the baby boomers age, there's going to be more people needing services. The interesting part is that between 2010 and 2040, you see the increase is almost double. So you go from about 11 million up to 20.9 million. That's a kind of a staggering statistic when you look at where we are right now and our capacity and how we're going to develop that in time to anticipate the 2040 numbers. Americans using aging services will increase in all the areas, meaning you'll have increased use of nursing homes, you'll have increased use of home care, and you'll have increased use of informal assistance. The challenge that we'll have on the informal assistance relates back to the slide that said 43% of the people are single. You're not going to have as many folks around to do the informal assistance. So that number will be especially challenging as you move forward with more single demographic. Average person in assisted living is female, white, and over 85. I think a lot of people think there's this image of assisted living being people sitting around playing bridge and being polite. The increased acuity level that is out there is pretty staggering. Folks are over 85 before they end up in the assisted living. Basically, in a lot of our members, what they tell us is folks who used to be in hospitals are often discharged to nursing homes. Folks who used to be in nursing homes are often being cared for in their housing with services or assisted living setting. It's not kind of the vision that you usually see for housing with services out there. The impact on home health, nursing facility costs, is the next one. With all the multicolors, basically what this does is this tells you a tale of who takes care of who at what time. And the startling number is probably, as you see, the green line. As folks continue to age, if they do have a spouse, the spouse's ability to take care of the individual decreases as they age. So then you have an increasing amount of home care that's being used. when you overlay that with a higher percentage of singles, you aren't even going to have the spouse around, so you're going to have an increased reliance upon home care and other things. That's one of the trends that we're noticing that we're trying to address through more of a home care type of setting. Another factor that we look at when we're looking down the road at who's going to be able to afford and how are they going to pay for these things, the median net worth has declined for all age groups since the recession. That's no surprise. More of a surprise to us was that many of the baby boomers have absolutely no plan to pay for their long-term care. That's a pretty high percentage of folks there who are saying, well, we don't really have a plan. It's a little startling as you're trying to look forward and say, well, how are we going to structure a system when nobody has a plan for how they're going to pay for things? So what are some of the age wave implications? And then I'll turn it over to Jeff to go through kind of what our response has been in different ways. There's a huge growth in older adult population that's going to result in more need, more services. There's a decline in family caregiving as you have more people that are single, and you have, as people age, they can't give the same amount of care to their families. The population in assisted living, as I said, is basically sicker and frailer than most people think. More older adults living alone will lead to greater demand on home care and more use of assisted living, as they won't be able to upkeep their house either. And finally, even though most assisted living is paid for privately, public funding is going to be essential, especially when you look at the component of we don't really have a plan on how to pay for it as we move forward. That was the most common response for people in long-term care. So now I'll turn it over to Jeff to walk through some of how we've been responding as a profession.
Thanks, Toby. Yeah, I'm going to go through some of the trends in service delivery and in long-term care in particular, starting out with the one that's labeled decline in nursing facility utilization. The actual measure here is the length of stay, the mean and median, or a couple ways of measuring the average. And basically, there's been a dramatic decrease, especially since 2000, in these figures. And what it means is there's a lot more short-term nursing home stays than there used to be. And so the entire environment, as Toby was talking about, of the care center has changed. It's more of a post-acute model in most cases. There's still some long-term people staying in nursing homes, but that's not the primary part of the business anymore. And the next slide kind of captures some of that change, particularly on the information about Medicaid days and how if you go back a little over 20 years, we used to have about 5.6 million more of those. Also, private pay days are dropping. Other payers, it doesn't show up so much on this graph, but Medicare and the other payers for post-acute type services has been growing pretty significantly as a percentage over that time. But I'd point out that the drop-off in Medicaid is a huge issue for the state. Now, granted, some of those people, as we'll get into, are in other settings where the state is paying for their care, but the state is saving a significant chunk of money to not be paying for, roughly 5 to 6 million Medicaid days that they were paying for 20 years ago. The next slide is the number of beds available, which kind of tracks along with the drop-off in days. We've seen a fairly steady decline in the nursing home bed supply from over 45,000 to now around 30,000. There's a question going into the future about whether that decline can continue when you look at the age wave that we've been talking about today. At some point, even if your utilization rate can continue to go down to some extent, at some point your bed supply may have to go back up to just because of the sheer numbers of people, particularly in the 85-plus range, who use it the most. The next slide is an interesting one because you may have heard over the years talk about how Minnesota is, relatively speaking, overbedded for nursing homes, which has been true for a long time, and going back into the 90s, as you can see, was true, at least to the extent that we had more beds per people 85-plus than the rest of the country did. Those lines have basically converged over the last few years, so the shift in the way services are provided in Minnesota is now paralleled with the rest of the country. So the argument that we're overbedded no longer makes the kind of sense that it did 15 years ago. The next slide is another way of looking at length of stay. It again shows a lot fewer long-term staying people and many more short-term staying people. More than half of people now
stay less than 30 days. So that post-acute component of what nursing homes do is a big part of their business model, and it really, to some extent, they've kind of split into serving two populations. You have the long-term care population, which is smaller in nursing homes but bigger out in assisted living and things like that, and that's been much less, at this point, at least, influenced by ACOs and some of these healthcare delivery models that that are being implemented over the last few years. On the post-acute side, there's increasing focus, increasing partnerships on how that service integrates with what the hospital and primary care systems are doing to try and decrease costs, improve outcomes. So like I said, it's an interesting split there. Now the next slide is the first time we brought up specifically housing with services units, which is the basic non-nursing home alternative of residential services for older adults. It includes some, most of them are registered as assisted living, some are not, but these are the units that are basically serving older adults in a residential setting who need some kind of services. And as you can see, it's a dramatically larger number today than nursing home beds. And the next slide shows the elderly waiver versus the nursing home. So the shift in the number of Medicaid clients who are out in the community versus in the nursing home, those lines crossed a few years ago, and we would anticipate that in the future they'll stay this way and perhaps spread out further as more people are able to be served in the community on what's known as the waiver program. The next slide is one that we like to point out often to the state in terms of the ability of the alternatives to the nursing home to the elderly waiver program's potential to save money, because the cost per client is less to the state for people on elderly waiver. So basically, if you make the assumption that everyone who's in a nursing home on Medicaid, everyone who's on EW in the community on Medicaid was in a nursing home on Medicaid, which would be the alternative that would be available to them if we didn't have an EW program, the cost would be somewhere in the range of $275 million to the state every year. So having these alternatives available is very beneficial to the state from a budgetary point of view. The next slide looks at hospital discharges and where they go, and the primary point is still the vast majority of people discharged from the hospital go directly to home without any follow-up, but there is an increased use in home care. There's an increased use in nursing facility placement after people leave. Part of that is just the aging of the population and the fact there's more people on Medicare who are eligible for those kinds of benefits, but there is an increasing use of those type of post-acute care services, and the hope there is that with shorter hospital stays and better follow-up that you have fewer readmissions. So even though you're paying for these services, the quality improves and the net cost is an improvement. So to kind of sum up where we are, the significant decline in care center beds has been coupled with a lot of development of alternatives. I think there's an expectation that'll continue. There's a lot fewer short stay residents than there's a lot more short stay residents than there have been, a lot fewer long stay. When you look at just the nursing home, it's become, as Toby said, more of an alternative hospital type of service almost. And there's some question about, both for housing the services and for nursing homes, what the trends are in the future in terms of how many beds are going to be available, where they're going to be, and what it means for some of the older providers out there, depending on their location. And then finally, for just a couple more slides, we put in the mandatory complaining about rates section, so I won't focus too much on that, but the Medicaid rates obviously are a concern for nursing homes. Our Medicaid rate has a larger gap with the cost of care than the national average, as seen on the next slide. And we put in North Dakota because they are the only other state that has rate equalization, and they have relatively no gap. So Minnesota, as we all know, is a challenging place to operate for nursing homes. And most of the revenue still comes from Medicaid, as the next slide shows. So we've shifted towards having a lot more post-acute care, but those patients don't stay as long, so your patients who do stay a long time at this point are still driving the financial model to a significant extent. The next slide is some data we collected from our members who participate in EW, because, again, while that program is great that it makes alternatives available to people, again, the payment rates, which have been cut substantially over the last few years, are well short of covering the cost of actually serving that population. The next slide takes a look at costs from a state perspective, and the fact that over time the care center costs have gone down as you serve fewer people, and you can see the lower line, the EW costs are going up. At some point, perhaps those lines will cross. The reason they haven't crossed yet, like the enrollees, is because the cost per person is much higher in the nursing home than it is for EW. And interestingly, because of some of the state reforms that they're looking at, that they often look at as called Reform 2020, level of care changes are part of that, and return to community and some of those efforts, they're looking right now into the future at the cost of both programs being relatively modest growth. Part of that is the demographics, the fact that the 85 plus population doesn't really start growing for another 10 years or so. So if you take the graph out a little farther, you'd probably see some spikes on both of these programs. But interesting to note that in the short term, there's not projections of big growth on either the nursing home or EW side. And finally, we just want to point out a couple of concerns that we have about the underfunding. It raises questions about whether we're going to be able to maintain nursing home services everywhere they're needed in the state. There have been some closures in the last couple of years. We expect that there may be some more coming. There are workforce challenges that they're facing that are in part caused by the rates that you're paid, because you're not able to compete effectively as an employer to get the workforce you need. And the same thing could potentially play out for people who are participating in the elderly waiver program. Those home and community-based services providers, to the extent that they're serving a disproportionately large share of EW clients and the EW rates are well short of the cost of providing care, again, raises the question in the long run of whether they can continue to operate and effectively serve those populations. So that's all we have, and we're certainly open to questions.
Thank you. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the question that I have, and then I have a follow-up with a comment, and thank you. Very good. Very good presentation again. What is the cost, average cost, per month to be in a nursing home in Minnesota today?
It's about $170 a day, so I'm trying to do the math in my head on what that would be for 30 days, but it used to be about $4,000. It's probably close to $5,000 now, if I'm doing the math right. So
okay, and I knew it at $4,000, and I thought it should be up around $5,000 a day now. And I just want to talk a little bit about the rates that we did get a 5% increase in the rates this last session, when we're really, 20 to 25% a day behind in the rates. Is that correct?
Yes.
And still?
Yes.
Still. And so the 5% is a spit in the bucket that we got them. And we are aging. And I come from that background, and I've fought this battle up here for 40-some years, and we've gotten very little attention. However, we will we'll have to get lots more attention because of the tsunami is already here. We're here. And so a lot of this that concerns me, however, is the fact that, yes, it is, the nursing home of today is an acute hospital. That's where you go after you have major surgery, a hip replacement, knees, and other things that the disease process gives us as we age, to go there, and then they are discharged to go home. And I don't want people to think that, oh, good, we've solved that problem. They're discharged. That doesn't mean they're discharged in the healthiest way that they could possibly be. And oftentimes they end up going home, and then they regress and they readmit. And so I think we need to look at the whole picture here. I just wanted to get that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fritz.
Members, any further questions or comments? Thank you very much. We often talk the long-term care issue is kind of the elephant in the room when it comes to this, the cost issue that we're here to talk about. Thank you so much for participating, and audience, thanks for being here. From this point forward, Representative Halverson and I are going to talk about where we go from here. We do plan on having more meetings. The timing is what's up for discussion. We'll be talking with members about that to see what the best way is forward with session starting in just under 2 weeks. So thank you so much, presenters, for once again laying some great foundation for continued conversation. With that, we're adjourned.
Thank you.